When I had completed these musings on the art of parenting, I reminded myself of a vignette from my own life as a parent. I had been asked to bring home a certain item. And as is the way of fathers, I chose the wrong size and the wrong brand. As I was unpackaging my good intentions, there was a moment of pregnant silence, broken only by my then 6-year-old saying, "Well, Dad, back to the drawing boards." There are no master blueprints guaranteed to build the happy family. I'm sure that Dr. Spock, while he was raising his sons, often went back to the drawing board, to his books, to his clinic, in order to find the understanding with which to understand and to cope with them. You remember when the philosophy of togetherness was being peddled about as the cure-all, the master plan? If you only became a pal to your child, all would be well. Remember those seemingly interminable hours spent drowsily watching with feigned excitement the little league games? And how you tired yourself out driving 2,000 miles and more of a weekend for a single, negligent, over-the-shoulder, "Hi, Mom," from a preoccupied camper? Well, there's no statistical evidence that the father pal or the mother sister solved the enigma that is junior any more successfully. There was a great deal of statistical evidence that father came rather early on to recognize that he had come to middle age through his aching bones. "I just don't understand it, Rabbi. We did everything together. The family was so close. I just don't understand why he should feel the need to pick up and to leave this comfortable room here and set up an apartment on his own." You remember that wonderful cartoon by Mr. Charles Adams? You see the usual sallow-faced, emaciated, ghostly figures. Mother and father and the two monsters, happily busy together, running out of the door of a bank, the loot, the guns in their hands. And the caption, "Now there's real togetherness for you." Parenting defies neat phrasing. And I think it's time that we all buried these 10 commandments for parents, these guideposts which gush out at us from the newspapers and the magazines and from the popular pulpit. Some of them are quite pretentious. You've seen them. "The family that prays together stays together." Alibi. Then there's a variation on the theme. "The family that plays together stays together. At least until father wheezes to a heart attack on the basketball court. Her mother breaks her leg skiing." Some of the best parents I know, and the wisest, have done nothing more athletic with their children except a fast game of chess of a long summer evening. It took one of our manufacturers, a man who made molding compound to cap all this silliness. He wrote in one of his advertisements, "The family that clays together stays together." I found this a bit sticky. But I admit that it does point up the utter lack of form, the shapelessness, the lack of content of all of these advertising panaceas, all of these guys to do-it-yourself parenting. Psychology, parent education, sociology, yes, even Judaism, cannot give you the wisdom with which to raise your children. There's simply too many variables. Their talents and yours. Their emotional structure and yours. The family's standards of discipline and of values. The family's socioeconomic level, and so on and on. Besides that, there's always the many defeats that the psychiatrist and the sociologist and the child guidance expert, and yes, even the rabbi, suffers in his own child raising. If his science were so complete, he would escape these, but believe me, we have the dark, unexpected turns in our own lives. I remember when our oldest was but two, and we planned to take a vacation. I've been trained to be sensitive to psychological factors, to think always of the emotional context. And I became worried when 2 days before our scheduled departure, the youngster became fretful, moody, and given to temper. Visions of all manner of trauma danced before my eyes. And you guessed it. A day later, even as we were discussing whether or not we ought to cancel the trip, he broke out into a good, healthy rash. It was nothing more or less than roseola. All of our wisdom, then, is but the beginning of wisdom. We have good advice. The inherited wisdom of the race has taught certain basic truths about the art of being a parent. But that's about all. Being a parent is to live, to struggle. There's no science to it. There are no guarantees. There's no predictability. There's no neat formula which we can put upon a blackboard and say, follow this, solve this equation. You will have solved the problems. Once upon a time, when a parent said that he was raising his child by the book, it meant no more or less than that he was making the boy toe the mark. There was discipline and strictness in the home. Today, the phrase must be construed quite literally. So many of us set aside our own judgment for the pet theory, for the writings of someone else. You know the classic story, don't you, of the mother whose darling threw a magnificent temper tantrum on the floor of the kitchen? And as she walked over the boy, she said to him, "Now, darling, just keep it up for a minute or two more while I run upstairs and get Dr. Spock so I know what to say to you." The book for many parents today is Dr. Freud. For many parents have turned the responsibilities of parenthood into the discipline of psychiatry. They refuse to take what the boy or girl asks at face value. They almost always must look under and behind and within. "Dad, can I have the car tonight?" "Why?" "Well, I just want to go out with the boys." "Why?" "I don't know, we just want to have fun." "Well, tell me, you know, if Junior, if you want to get away from me, if you just have to get out of the home, just tell me. Let's sit down. There's nothing we can't talk over." "Dad, for once in your life, give me a straight yes or no." And then there's the parent who raises the child by the Bible of frankness. The full, utter, exact, unadulterated, indigestible truth. "Mommy, where did I come from?" This is the moment that many young mothers, contemporary mothers, wait for with great glee. They're ready, primed, with a 45-minute lecture on the literal facts of reproduction. No child should have anything that is uncertain to them. And this mother plunges into her science lecture, and 45 minutes later, when she stops for breath, "But Mommy, teacher today asked us at school where we came from. And Junior came from Buffalo, and Jimmy came from New York City. I just want to know where I came from." It's a strange fact of our life, isn't it? That we bow and bend our best judgment before the opinions of others. Now, there's good advice that can be given. There's good advice that ought to be heard. Time and again we block from ourselves the unwelcome facts, the ugly facts. We don't want to hear them. It's important to have an open mind. But it's also important to make up our own minds. Rabbi, what should I tell my daughter about God? Has she asked you? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, she asked me last week. Well, what'd you tell her? I told her that I'd ask you. I don't know your child as well as you do. Some children can be answered quite literally, must be answered literally. God is the creator, the fashioner of the world. Some children can think in abstract terms. God is the spirit that infuses the universe. Some children ask for no better reason than to divert your attention from some other subject nearer at hand. Some children ask because they heard their playmates asking their parents. They don't really want an answer. I don't know your child. I don't know the context in which the conversation took part. We can give you information, but ultimately you must apply it. It is your child, in your home, part of your life, and your understanding. A child guidance counselor in the schools has met with your boy or girl 2, 3, 4 hours. He has before him also some diagnostic test results, clean figures on clear paper. But the tests themselves are of uncertain reliability. And though this person can give you good information, important information about college, about vocation, his world is limited by his own frail, circumscribed self, by his own attitudes, by his own preconceptions, by his own training, by his aptitudes. Ultimately, you must take that which is available and make the judgment for yourself. What he says to you is not gospel truth, Torah l'Moshe m'Sinai, the revealed word of God to Moses on Sinai, but I'm constantly amazed at the number of parents who suspend their own judgment and bow themselves meekly before some presumed expert in the field. Science permits experts. Art does not. Art requires appreciation. And this kind of art, which is the painting, which is the building, requires some creative talent. And there are no absolute rules for it. Some men paint in one medium and some paint in another. Some parents raise their children successfully with discipline and some in a rather permissive home. And there are no guarantees in either. It is you, you alone, who know your child best. I prize, therefore, a phrase from our book of Proverbs. It's somewhat excessively stated, but there's a truth in it nevertheless. Train up your son in the way that he should go, and he will follow you all the days of your life. Now, the best of sons raised by the best of parents will not follow that parent the rest of his life. Human nature is simply too idiosyncratic. But the address of this proverb appeals to me. Train up your child. You train your child. You, father, you, mother, yours is the responsibility. Not the synagogues, not the schools, not the vocational guidance places, but yours and yours alone. Take back unto yourselves the burden of responsibility. You must discharge it. But when a generation such as ours shows a tendency to shrug off responsibility, to have little faith in its own judgments, we must ask the reasons why. Why is it that so many parents run to the book? Why is it that so many parents run to the psychologist, or run to the rabbi? Why is it that they have so little faith in their own judgment? In part, I think the answer lies in the current mystique of expertise. We are ignorant in the fields of science, and we need guidance. And in science, there is only one right, and the rest is wrong. And any man who is the scientist can lead us in his discipline. But we have somehow assumed that they in the social sciences and that there are human sciences, and there are not, and that there are experts in these disciplines. There are only men of understanding and men of sympathy. But there is in and among us, part of the air that we breathe, this mystique of the expert. God forbid that we should read with our children, teach them to read unless we have a teaching certificate. And you know, if you volunteer today to tidy beds up in a hospital or to read to patients, you have to first put up with a series of lectures by some masters in social work on the psychodynamics of the volunteer. And our children are being told to choose their career by a number of diagnostic tests which a computer ranges against the average skills of the average person in the average field. We run to the expert. We seek assurance. But in life, there are no assurances. Ultimately, we must make the decisions for ourselves. The child coming adult is an achievement. You cannot predict. There is no science to it, only love and understanding and wisdom. But the mystique of expertise, I think, is only part of the answer. We bow to the judgments of others as parents, I think, for another reason. We breathe the atmosphere of psychological cliché. Most of us live under the fear that what we do as parents will permanently and forever mar and scar that youngster. Dr. Freud showed clinically that the neuroses that he treated were often intimately related to childhood trauma. Many mental diseases begin in unfortunate childhood experiences, and any number of theoreticians jumped off from there and said that the man is but an enlarged child, that the man cannot change over the years, that after 6 or 7 or 10, your personality, your character is fixed, immutable. There's a point in the cutting of a precious stone, of a diamond, when a single tap will break away the husk and reveal the full beauty of the stone. Neatly hit, the full range of the stone's beauty is revealed. Muffed, the lines of force within the jewel are such that it disintegrates, it becomes worthless powder. And most parents today live as if they are about to take that final tap. We are indecisive because we are uncertain of the carnage which we may inflict. Junior may deserve a smack across the back, but our hand hesitates. We discipline and we are permissive alternately. We're afraid of consistency. Why? Because we live under the fear that we are ultimately the sculptors of the adult. There's a foreboding quality to being a parent today, and a dangerous one at that. And there is also, obviously, the reflex of this in the adult world. That tendency to unbecoming whimpering by the weak. How they love to sit back on some couch or to pour out their troubles to some patient friend, and how their own laziness and their own indolence and their own insufficiencies are blamed on the self-sacrifice and the love of parents long gone. It's part of the culture in which we live. But it's not scientifically so, and it's time that parents were freed of this fear under which they live. The child himself sculpts the man. The child determines what he will be. Some years ago, I asked the confirmation class on their final examination to explain to me each of the Ten Commandments. And one of the youngsters spoke or wrote an unwitting truth. He'd come to the commandment, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long upon the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. And he wrote this by way of explanation. This means that our parents brought us here and that they are raising us here to the best of our ability. To the best of our ability, not of theirs. Parents are not gods. Parents do not determine whether the child will work, whether the child will have goals, whether there is emotional drive built within him. The best of families produces its black sheep, and the best of parents sometimes fail with children. It's up to the child, not to the parent. And even God, you know, even God does not assume responsibility for our actions. See, I have set before thee this day the blessing and the curse, life and death. Choose ye life that ye may live. You choose it. You're responsible, not I. My son, you choose the life that you will live. You're responsible, not I, the parent. On Yom Kippur, when we get up to confess, we don't say, for the sins which our parents sinned against us, but for the sins which we have sinned against thee. Ours are the sins. Many look on the ancient Hebrew law as rather grim. But it's interesting that our fathers required only three things of the adult world in relationship to children. A father must provide protection and provision and education. The rest is up to the child. Protection, provision, and education. The rest is up to the child. Very little is said about love and tenderness, gaiety, life, palsiness, if there's such a word. Protection, provision, education. It's up to the child to respect. It's up to the child to be disciplined. It's up to the child to help to build happiness into the home. Why must parents always entertain the child? Why can't the child do something but whine and wheedle when he's at home? Why do we assume that we alone are responsible for bringing interesting things, conversation to the table? Why can't the child be partially responsible for his share of family life? It may be a little grim. Surely a home ought to have lightness and happiness within its walls. But it does serve to put the shoe on the right foot. The ultimate responsibility for the man is the child's, not the adult's. Raise him and raise him well. Give him as many advantages as are possible. Help him to become an adult. Make his life a happy and healthy one, if you can. But ultimately, don't live his life for him. And don't assume that you bear the final responsibility for your child when he's 20, 30, and 40. Men have come out of horrible home surroundings and become great men. Men have been starved for love. Men have come out of broken homes. All manner of emotional carnage has been inflicted upon some young unfortunates, and they have grown into men, fine men, sometimes even saintly men. The quality is the child's. The decision is the child's. The responsibility is the child's. And there's still a third reason, I believe, why we quiver to make judgments, why we're afraid of our own rules and regulations, and that's because we have children many times before we have judgment. Let me ask you a question. When your child first made his appeal from your decision, discipline, what have you, and we turned to you and said, "But Daddy, don't be a square," how'd you react? Be honest. It hurt. We don't like to think of ourselves as old fogies and fuddy-duds, as some relic from a prehistoric age. But why did it hurt? It hurt because we live in a world which prizes the carefree, the young in heart, those who break the bounds, those who adventure beyond the known. Our art is pointedly without rules. Our music is frankly experimental. Our philosophy is determinedly open-ended. Our morality is flexible and relativistic. We pride ourselves on breaking the rules, on having few traditions. When was the last time that you were called by a teenager something other than Al or Gert? You're made happy by this being brought down to the child's level. Why? Because there's something childish in our culture. We're rebels, constantly rebelling, and it has brought us great technological advance, but it has roiled every single fundamental of social living. What does it mean to be a square? It means simply to have made up your mind that there's a right and that there's a wrong. That this is the way you live, and you will not live any other way. Now, it may be very avant-garde, advanced, to believe that moralities are conventional things. You may yourself feel above moral decisions, but a child needs to know what's right and what's wrong. How else can he develop a conscience? It may be very avant-garde and very advanced to believe that spiritual things are relics of some ancient past. But a child needs spiritual rootings. He needs to feel anchored in and wanted in this world. You may like to feel yourself a free spirit soaring happily above society, gay and carefree, fulfilling every one of the Madison Avenue requirements of the sociables. But a child needs rules. He needs to know exactly how he can please. He needs to have his lesson and his homework in living set out for him, black on white. He needs that security. Deny it to him, and you deny him emotional security. A parent must, perforce, be a square. He must give his child a square deal. If he promises, he must pay. If he speaks to his child of discipline, he must live the disciplined life. Mother has been complaining that her children have been appropriating the playthings of their neighbors. Why? Because this is expected of mothers. And yet that evening, the youngsters sit around a table where mother and father chortle with glee at some rather mean and nasty business of political chicanery. Parents must know the commitments, the standards, the moral values which are theirs, which cannot be compromised, which they will not compromise, and that is the beginning of being a parent. Now, there are many among us who refuse to make such square decisions, the free spirits. And they have their own rationalization. You've heard it again and again and again. It's done in the name of freedom. I want my child to make up his own mind. I want my child to find out for himself by trial and error. Experience is the best teacher. How in the world is any child going to relive the accumulated civilization and learning of the world in 20 years? Experience is simply too limited. We don't ask a budding scientist to repeat all experiments which science has ever performed since the days of Hippocrates and Galen. Why should we force our children to make every mistake that has ever been made by men since the ages of the caveman? How long will a child live if he must find out for himself whether he can dart into the street after a ball? And you know this too. There is no more difficult process than the decision-making process. Who is paid the most in our society? The executive who has the ability to make decisions, to be decisive. Most of us shy from it. We're afraid of the consequences. We need a great deal of information. And yet we ask of the child, young, innocent, his mind not yet developed, to make every basic moral decision. It took mankind 100,000 years and more of humanity to come to the Ten Commandments. We expect the child to have these and every other commandment of modern living by his early teens on his own. What nonsense. Child needs rules. Later on, if he disagrees with you, he will change the rules. Raw energy is useless until we have channeled it into the high-tension lines. Raw human energy is useless until it has been channeled into useful and usable lines of action. And how do we channel these raw lines of energy within us? Psychiatric term is sublimation. We build rules. We set up a structure of social living. And the child learns that there are certain things he cannot do, and these channels of energy are turned around and finally find their way to flow into some more constructive and useful and beneficial channel. Aggressiveness becomes the release of sport. The drive to dominate becomes the drive to learn. So it is with all of the basic instincts. Children need parents who have matured to the point where they have made judgments. There is no worse parent for a child than the childish parent. The parent who is afraid to be a square. The parent who wants to keep on being the child. What I'm saying then is simply put, the art of being a parent is no more and no less than the art of being an adult, of admitting that we are beyond the carefree years. Doesn't mean that we can't be happy, our homes can't be filled with laughter, that we can't adventure out intellectually and emotionally into the great world beyond. It does mean that we are now anchored to the ties of love which we have voluntarily assumed, anchored to the ties of work which provide, anchored to the ties of community which support and sustain within which we live. Our feet are squarely on Mother Earth. Our mind has squared itself away and come to some certain judgment as to the right, to the proper, and to the necessary. Train up your child in the way that he shall go, and he will follow you all the days of his life. No man can make you that promise. Ultimately, the best of training may fall short. But this much is sure. The responsibility to train is yours. And you can only discipline the child when you yourself are disciplined. You can only discipline the child when you yourself are certain of the values which you hold sacred. Before you have children, grow up. And if you have children already, cease to be the child. Well, Dad, back to the drawing board. Amen.